Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Jim Dunn gives a Dharma Talk entitled Offering Respect and Kindness, an Introduction to Buddhist Ethics. According to Buddhist teachings, we can transform the habits of heart and mind through the practice of generosity and moral discipline. This forms a foundation and a frame for our practice, and a guide to how we most skillfully live in the world. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Taksim Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Jim Dunn. I am one of the teachers here. And I will be giving the talk today. I'm not Lama Cathy, if you were expecting her, because she was on the schedule. No, she called me last week, and I think it was like Tuesday, and thought she might get tied up and not be able to be back today. And would I be able to teach if she couldn't? And late Thursday, I got an email that she was not going to make it back, and I was up, so I had prepared a little bit of this talk a couple of months ago when she thought she might not be here, but it needed a little more work. It was, on that one, I think I had like 2 days' notice, and this one I had a few more, so I did give it a little work, but still, I would like a little more time to prepare these things. But anyway, here I am, and we will do what we can. So the title of the talk today is Offering Respect and Kindness, an Introduction to Buddhist Ethics. Transforming the habits of heart and mind through the practice of generosity and moral discipline. Now, in Buddhism, we don't talk about the precepts or the morality of it an awful lot, and it seems like we really should give it a little more attention. It is one of the core things of our teaching. It's in some ways the foundation. If you look at, like, the Eightfold Path, you know, we break it down into ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And of the Eightfold Path, four parts are clearly about morality. Right action, right speech, right livelihood. In the Six Perfections, morality is the second of the Six Perfections, following generosity. And generosity has a way, so I'll talk about a little bit, also puts us in to the idea of ethics of moral behavior, moral discipline. In one of the songs of the Theragata, they say, virtue is the foundation, the forerunner and origin of all that is good and beautiful. Therefore, one should purify virtue. Now, many of us come to the Dharma for some sort of healing, some sort of lack or problem, something's missing in our lives. And usually we begin by talking a lot about meditation. And meditation is very important, and I have no problem with talking about it at the beginning. In fact, meditation is one of the things I can almost be evangelical about. I'd like to see the whole world meditating. But in and of itself, it's not always enough. We need a little more of a foundation for it. You know, the Buddha's been compared sometimes to a doctor dealing with spiritual life. You know, we have this problem, this suffering. And the Buddha says, we know this problem. We know its cause, greed, hatred, and delusion. And we can make it stop. And we have a medicine, the Eightfold Path, a practice. So in order to help fill our lack, you know, the one thing we need to do is begin with where we are, how we behave and interact in the world. You know, we sometimes, and Lama Cathy likes to summarize the whole Dharma with the four lines from the Dhammapada or those also from the Dignakata. Do not do any evil, but to cultivate the good, to purify one's mind. This the Buddhas teach. There's a number of different variations on that, but that is the basic teaching. So moral discipline Sila in Sanskrit and Pali, Sultram in Tibetan. Some of you may even have that name when you took refuge. It's one of the names fairly commonly given. Is actually the first step on the path. The five precepts is how it is usually taught, although it's included in almost all the other teachings in some way or another. Westerners are somewhat dismissive about the precepts. It sounds a lot like Sunday school, a list of do's and do nots. And yet it's much more than that. I mean, you can take them and when I go through the precepts, you know, we have a list of things that you shouldn't do, but we can enrich them a little bit. It's much more about being our internal state of being aware and developing intentional ethical behavior. These are guidelines for not doing evil and to help cultivate the good. They can be called upayas, which is a Sanskrit and Pali word that basically means skillful means. What these are about is skillful ways that lead to happiness and well-being, ways to avoid suffering. And I think that's kind of what we all want. And that's what the Dharma offers us, is lots of different kinds of skillful means. And this is, I think, that one of the foundational ones. In Greek ethics, from the Greek ethos, talks about character, seeking to be the kind of person we aspire to be. And that would also be a good way to look at sila, of ethics, or morality. How do we become who we want to be, who we think we can be? One of the teachers I've encountered over the years was Roshi Bernie Glassman, who deceased at the beginning of this year. But he was a good Jewish man, and I don't know how many of you are a little bit familiar with Yiddish, but he thought the idea of the Dharma was to become a mensch, a real person. And I think he's right. So this is how we frame our practice and guide how we live, most skillfully live in the world. So the five precepts for lay people, and there's lots of different precepts for different kinds of levels of ordination, and they're usually given as, I undertake the training rule to refrain from harming living beings, to refrain from taking that which is not freely given, to refrain from lying or misleading speech, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from the use of intoxicants that lead to carelessness or heedlessness. And notice these begin with their training rules. These are not hard and fast do's or don'ts. These are things we are to look at and use to guide our life, to consider. They're also an aspect of generosity, the first of the six perfections. If you remember the teachings on generosity, the six perfections, if you don't know, are the six steps that lead to becoming a bodhisattva. The six ways we develop that. And generosity we talk about as having three kinds. First of all, the generosity is giving material goods, money. When I was at the Theravadin Society and the Bhavan Society in West Virginia on Vesak, it was sort of fun to see in front of the altar all kinds of things given, including crates of toilet paper. But something very useful there and something they needed. So that is the first kind. The second time of generosity is the generosity of protection. And I'm going to talk about that a little more. The third kind of generosity is giving the Dharma, teaching the Dharma, or leading people to the Dharma. But under the generosity of perfection, consider if we lived in a world where we had everybody following these precepts of not harming, of not taking that which we haven't given away, which is not freely given. If we could trust people, they wouldn't lie to us or mislead us. That we could feel secure in our relationships, people would behave appropriate to the relationships. And we wouldn't run into people that are intoxicated and misbehaving that way. How much better we'd feel, how much more secure we would be, how much safer we'd be in the world. A few years ago, I was in Burma, Myanmar, and I was told at that time that we really didn't need to worry a lot about theft. The people were, it was such a Buddhist country, and people really had bought into these precepts so much that they really wouldn't steal. And often when we travel to third world countries, we live for tips for like hotel staff, things like T-shirts. And they kept running down to give them back. We had to tell them, no, this is a gift. This is for you. My wife had an experience where she accidentally had some money kind of hanging out her purse. And anybody walking by could have just reached in and grabbed it. And a woman tapped her on the shoulder and pointed it out to her and tapped it back in so she wouldn't lose it. I mean, this is the kind of honesty that you get if you really follow the precepts. And it would be just such a lovely thing if we lived in such a world, wouldn't it? This is how we bring the Dharma into our daily life. And they're pretty clear. I mean, these five are very simple statements. If you just take these as they stand, and we can elaborate on them a bunch, but they're all pretty clear-cut. You know, they're not really giving you a lot of loopholes. Not harming, you know, we just don't harm beings. Not taking that which isn't freely given, that kind of closes a loophole that some of us look for. And, well, it was just laying there. Nobody was saying not to take it. You know, many, many years ago, I owned a bar and a restaurant, and when nobody was looking, a guy reached over the counter and swiped a bottle of liquor. You know, when I told him he wasn't welcome back in the club again, he said, well, nobody stopped me. It's kind of like it was on somebody to stop him, or else, of course, they're going to steal. And that's not the way it works. If it isn't freely given, it's not yours. To refrain from lying or misleading speech, and this usually gets expanded into other types of speech, too. You know, we talk about right speech and the Eightfold Path. It also includes not just lying, but malicious speech, harsh speech. What's the other kind of speech? There's another kind of speech that we're not supposed to do. Gossip, idle speech, yes, idle speech. And those are all kind of part of this and good things to keep in mind. Sexual misconduct, basically that means honoring your commitments and the commitments of others. There's more refinements to it, but by and large, for our purposes today, if we just leave it at that, I think that'll be enough. You know, there are some discussion or teachings on who's available, if they're under the care of their parents or ordained people. They need to have their vows respected, those kinds of things. And intoxicants, what leads to carelessness or heedlessness, there's a story I kind of like. In old Tibet, travelers did not have a hotel to stop in. So monks that were wandering around would come to somebody's house and ask if they could stay there. And one time, this monk was kind of wandering through Tibet, and it was getting late, and he came to this house. It was a pretty isolated house, not a lot of others around. And he asked the woman there if he could spend the night. And she said, well, yes, but you have to... I have a chicken we can have for dinner, and I want you to kill it. And the monk said, oh, no, I'm a monk. I've taken vows. I can't kill the chicken. I can't do that. Well, then she said, it's been pretty lonely here. I haven't had a man in a long time. I'd like you to sleep with me. And the monk said, oh, no, that's a big vow. I can't break that. So finally she said, well, at least you can have a drink with me. So he had a drink with her. And in the morning, he woke up in her bed with memories of a chicken dinner. So beware. Now, some of the teachings say, and as we develop our practice, I think it's kind of true, that as we become more and more enlightened, that these precepts will become less and less important because we will automatically respond in an appropriate way. But many of us are not that enlightened yet, and I kind of think having these rules in mind and following them kind of help begin where we are. You know, the practice as it develops, you will do better, and you will become more aware and more aware of things you want to go wrong. And as I think I said the last time I sat up here, the old Chinese teacher Yu Men, lived in the 10th century, was asked the teaching of his entire life, and he summed it up, an appropriate response. And sometimes I think, you know, there's different levels of morality that people have and go through, looking for loopholes. You know, if you were to find a wallet, like in the bathroom, nobody's around and looking, most of you, I would hope, say, somebody lost their wallet, I have to try to get it back to them. A few of you, I hope not, but a few of you might, see if there's some cash in it and take out the cash and then say, I found this wallet, somebody already got any cash. A few of you might just take the wallet, take the cash, and use the credit cards. And when we were traveling last year, we stopped at a motel in Buffalo and got back on the road, and my wife's wallet was missing. As it turned out, she dropped it getting into the car. It fell out of her purse. And she was all prepared to get all her credit cards stopped and everything when we got back. But there in our mailbox, somebody found it, and there was a wallet mailed back, intact, full. Some stranger found it, wrapped it up, took the trouble to send it. That is really good karma. That's kind of what I hope everyone would think about doing in a situation like that. So by following the precepts, we are aligning ourselves by creating good karma. The teachings on karma emphasize the importance of intention. As it says in the Dhammapada, and as Lama Kathy was recited more than once, all experiences preceded by mind, led by mind, made by man. You know, with bad thoughts, ill will happens, bad things happen. With good thoughts, it's always beneficial. So in the Four Noble Truths, when we get to the point about ethics, morality, well, first of all, we have right view, which is kind of the view that the Four Noble Truths of supporting those, of understanding the path. Right intention is understanding the law of karma, cause and effect, of generosity, of loving kindness, and compassion, sometimes stated in the negative, lack of ill will or hate or renunciation. But then we get into right speech. I've talked about that a little bit, the four types. Right action is basically doing things that are wholesome, not bad, not harming, following the precepts. Right livelihood is avoiding careers that lead us to do non-karmic things, working in a slaughterhouse, working for an arms manufacturer. Those kinds of things are probably not the best things to do. Other ways to make a living that are much more wholesome. Those can go on and be elaborated in a number of different ways and can get very complex. But I will let you think about that. And right effort is, well, and mindfulness and concentration are the wisdom part that we're not talking about so much today. So as we follow these precepts, it'll help us develop kindness and compassion for ourselves and others. Again, they are not thought of as rules or regulations strictly to be adhered to, but valued as a foundation for the ethical way of living, because they lead us to reflect on our behavior and its impact on others. They can be thought of as a gift of protection, as I said, by offering others confidence that they and their possessions are respected and our commitments will be made. In the Mahayana, the precepts we emphasize more on compassion, calling us to look more at our intentions and then the consequences of our actions. We think of them in terms of the six perfections, which I've been talking about. So there's three ways we can sometimes look at how we practice these. There's sort of the ethic of restraint. I simply won't do that. You know, this is kind of putting rules on ourselves. And that's the beginning way. There's the ethics of cultivating virtue. The more I do this, the better my mind will be. I'm getting virtue, I'm developing merit, good karma, and that will be helpful for the future. And then the final one, the highest one, is the ethics of altruism, offering kindness and compassion. And typically, you know, we often talk in this tradition especially about when we do good things, of offering the merit of it. If you do a good act, you do it not just for yourself, but for the benefit of all beings, or for another person, or however you want to dedicate it. But whatever good you do, whatever good you acquire, we try to give it away. We try to make it beneficial for everyone. This is not about us. And the whole of Dharma can be thought of in a way as just kind of chipping away at our narcissism, our self-cherishing. Almost everything is kind of attacking the idea that I'm important, the needy me, the greedy mine, those three. We're just kind of working our way to kind of cut those out, their importance, becoming liberated from them. And any action that's tainted by greed, craving, attachment, aversion, hatred, pushing things away, or just simply delusion, we don't know what the hell we're doing. Those are the things that have some sort of karmic impulse or effect. So anything that are done with those kinds of things. So as we get past that, of just doing things because it seems to be the right thing to do, because it's the right thing to do, without any kind of selfish motivation, is the highest kind of following the precepts. Most of us probably aren't there yet. But, you know, we try to get past that sense of self. Now, occasionally we make exceptions. Well, they talk in some of the teachings about making exceptions. Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara, the way of the Bodhisattva, talks a little bit about that there sometimes can be some exception to this. But I kind of think of that as the disclaimers you used to see after watching stunt drivers on TV. These are being done by professional and well-trained bodhisattvas. Do not try this at home, kids. it takes some time. Shantideva has a whole chapter in The Way of the Bodhisattva on vigilance, he calls it. It's basically the chapter. It should be on ethics, and that's kind of what he's getting at. But it's really all about mindfulness, about vigilance, about how we pay attention to our minds. And he says, lack of vigilance is like a thief who slinks behind when mindfulness abates, and all the merit we gather in, he steals, and down we go to lower realms. Constantly guarding the mind with mindfulness is really what we need to work on. That's why we practice mindfulness. That's part of why we meditate. But as you learn and practice the precepts and just kind of get them internalized, part of your behavior, you'll find you're doing much better. And it also makes your meditation a little deeper. It's kind of hard to meditate really well when you're feeling like you've really done something bad, when you have a guilty conscience, or you're ashamed. In Buddhism, we talk sometimes about some of the motivations for doing things, and one is, I would hate to think of myself as the kind of person that steals or does these other bad things. And the other one is a little more like shame. I would hate for you to think I'm a thief. I would hate for you to think that of me. So those are kind of the things that we try to think of when we're doing that. But Shantideva, you know, really goes kind of all in on this. When temptations arise or you find yourself yearning for wealth, attention, fame, etc., then it is like a log you should remain. Just sit there. Don't respond. Examine yourself from every side. Note harmful thoughts and every futile striving. This is what the heroes in the Bodhisattva path apply remedies to keep a steady mind. But all this must be acted out in truth, for what is to be gained by mouthing syllables? what invalid was ever helped by merely reading the doctor's treatise. So that's a reminder. You know, I said at the beginning that sometimes this is looked, it's almost a medical thing, a problem, a solution, a cause, a solution, and a medicine. But if we just read about it, it's not going to help us very much. So as we practice, there are three ramifications that it has. It shapes your character, helps you to become what a mensch, a relief, the person you really want to be. It helps shape the character of others in the society we want to live in. As you behave, others will respond to you differently. And I typically joke when I teach meditation that when I began meditating, it was sort of surprising on how much nicer people became. And others will teach you in ways that correspond to your character. So those are the rough outlines on Shila, meditation. It's a caveat. One of the things that they warn us about sometimes is don't become overly attached to grasp at the precepts. These are training rules, and one of the forms of attachment that gets us in trouble is grasping onto concepts or teachings. We need to hold them openly and gently, make them useful, but not tightly. Don't get judgmental. He's doing bad things. He's going to be a bad person. That's kind of his problem. If you can, if you're on the bodhisattva path, possibly try to guide somebody. But really, you need to worry more about your own karma, your own actions, your own activity. So more in the Mahayana, we kind of go through these with the 10 non-virtues or the 10 virtues. And I'll kind of go through them and we can talk about them a little bit. The first is don't kill. Cultivate and encourage life. And this is being life-supporting. And I know we have a lot of issues with this in this culture. Several states are now talking about repealing the death penalty. Ohio still has it. It's one I wish they would do away with. When I was in New Mexico, they did away with it. But I think there's still one prisoner on death row there. You know, the military is always problematic on those kinds of things. But as we practice, we don't see things as separate from ourselves. We see and honor every being and thing as a manifestation of Buddha nature. So we try to respect all beings. So we look at things with compassion and loving kindness. You know, and sometimes, well, the Dalai Lama was once talking about like dealing with bugs. And he says quite often when he has a mosquito bothering him, he tries to let it be, let it go. But occasionally he slaps. This is a path, a training thing. Don't steal. Take only that which is freely given. Honor the gift not yet given. Do not place self-interest above consideration for others. Trust that you really have all you need. Try to let go of the sense of greediness, of neediness. And one of the teachers talks about dukkha, the first noble truth, that of suffering, as a lack of what you lack. As we work with that and explore that emptiness, that kind of lack we have, which is kind of the source of our greed, then that gives us a little more opening. Sexuality, that's always a big one for many people. Sexuality is one of the more important forces in our life, of attraction for pleasure. But we also sometimes use it for control or for other issues. And so, again, look at human intimacy with respect and care and honor it. Communicate truthfully. Do not hide your mistakes or your true nature with coarse or subtle lies. Speak from the heart. Again, do not become intoxicated, but try to be clear, to polish clarity, to dispel delusion. Don't take refuge in distractions. And one of the things that some of us get really lost in too much is things like television, which is not exactly wrong speech, but it is a distraction and it's sort of an addiction, and I think it kind of falls under that as something that can take away our clarity. Do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. Letting go of the past and future. develop some confidence in your own ability and the ability to others. Get in touch with your Buddha nature, your basic goodness. As I said the last time I sat up here, you're ultimately perfect, just as you are. But as Suzuki Roshi said, you could still use a little improvement. Do not be mean with Dharma or wealth. Share understanding. Give freely of the self. Basically, don't be stingy. Don't worry about lacking. Take every opportunity to be generous, to give it all away, holding on. And we can get pretty good at that, holding on. It's a practice that I know I need to work on a little more, and I am. But, you know, as one teacher said, though, you know, we can have this kind of grasping like this, but we can also just hold things like this, gently, openly, and that makes it a little easier, a little more relaxed. Don't indulge anger. Cultivate equanimity. Avoid the self-defensiveness, or this is my territory. Do what needs to be done with an attitude of acceptance and compassion. And finally, the three jewels. Respect the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the other way of looking at these is, well, the last ones especially, of mind. These break down into of body, not killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. So the four of speech, lying, harshness, slanderous or malicious speech, idle talk, and mind, coveting, the root of jealousy, of wanting things that others have. Letting that go. And when we talk about the four immeasurables, the immeasurable of, we have loving kindness, compassion, and joy. And part of that in some of the teachings is finding joy in the success of other people. You know, you have a job and you've applied for a promotion, and the idiot down the hall actually gets it. And, you know, you kind of want to be resentful there. But really, you know, somebody's had some success. Somebody's had something good happen. And that doesn't happen to a lot of people every day. So we should find a way to rejoice in that, to celebrate the success and the good things that happen to others. I know that can be a biggie for a lot of people. And holding malicious or hateful thoughts. And with the current political climate, I know I have to work on that a lot with some of our politicians. Oh, that is a real challenge. But we try. We try to be open, be compassionate, to realize that many of them are acting as best they can out of their karma, their way. And the final one, the last, the wrong views, involves things like denying karma, the law of cause and effect, that our actions have no consequences. That's almost being nihilistic. And accepting the karma, or knowing that karma does have causes, that it is important, it is crucial to our path, that whatever we do have effects on us and in the future. Accepting and taking refuge in the Buddha Sangha and Dharma, or Dharma Sangha. So bringing our practice into the world through our Shila, our ethical life, is, as somebody put it, we talk about practice all the time. Well, as we really develop this, Shila becomes the concert that we've practiced for as we've developed it all. So I think that's all I'm going to say. Let's see if we can have a discussion. I've given out a lot. There is lots of little issues here that come up and people have questions on. And I do better responding to questions than I do just sitting here running my mouth. So please, any questions? All right, James.
For merit on there, you said that if an employee that you work with gets a promotion, mm-hmm. you'd be happy for
him. Yeah.
What if you believe that the promotion causes long-term harm, like it creates a bad culture, or it is a form of internal corruption or something like that? Do you think that would be a bad thing, even though it's a good thing for that individual?
I think you'd have to look at it in terms of the individual. That the individual had a good thing happen to him. In terms of the company culture, that whole thing, that's an issue that gets a little larger, and then that would raise the question of, why are you still working there? and what can you do to change that?
So, compared to in terms of individuals, more important than the effect on society?
I wouldn't quite put it that way. I mean, you're talking about a specific kind of event, example, and a specific kind of case. If there is a very negative kind of culture in a company, then you have to deal with that in ways you best you can. But on an individual level, I think, you know, you just try to find ways to rejoice when somebody gets something good. You may want to point it out if that person got the promotion for reasons that aren't quite totally ethical. There's somebody there to point it out to. But
talking more along the idea of making employment into a competition, in a sense, like a free market style situation, when that may not be ethical to force employees to compete with each other.
Well, again, that would be the culture of the company.
Hi, Jim. Thank
you. Hi, Marcus.
Thank you for your talk. It really, there's so much you can think about in terms of practical application from what you said, and I've had all kinds of things spinning in my head and things I'll work out. But I just wanted to mention less as a question, more as a comment. One that I've had to deal with for quite a few years now and continue to deal with as it actually becomes a bit of an addiction in some ways, and that is outrage, because it feels so good and you feel like you're doing the right thing, and yet it can be so poisonous to your mind and to your peace of mind, and so addictive, and it stands as a barrier between yourself and universally loving everyone. Because if you're outraged, you're outraged at someone, at someone's actions. And trying to separate the ability to act on something that needs to be acted on, to reject something that needs to be rejected, and still holding on to the idea that anger is poison, and that you need to love the perpetrator as much as the victims, and it's something I work on daily, and your teachings brought all that to mind. So thank you.
Yeah, that's an important concept. You know, somebody once joked that my mind is like a bad neighborhood. I don't want to go there alone. But the Buddha talks about some of these thoughts in one of the sutras. You know, one of the things you can do with these kinds of thoughts is try to replace them with a positive thought. You know, if I'm thinking, I wish that guy would just die or whatever, you know, try to replace that with another thought. In some ways, this is kind of one of the benefits of mantra practice, is you're feeling really outraged if you just start chanting, "Oh, Mani Pe Me Hum," over and over again, that'll replace it. Sometimes with these kinds of thoughts, you may want to just kind of examine them, take it down to the root. What is this really about? Finally, I wish I remember the exact quote, because it's wonderful the way it was written. But the Buddha said that if you really have a thought like that and you just can't get rid of it, he says, as a strong man would take a weak man and crush his head, you know, take that thought and crush it, as a strong man would crush a weak man, a weaker man.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if a vegetarian diet was recommended for Tibetan Buddhists.
Yeah, I think the Karmapa has actually tried to encourage it, and I know all the KTCs around the country in their own are vegetarian. It's not always possible to be a complete vegetarian, nor is he talk about that being necessary, but it really is a good aspiration to try to be vegetarian, to avoid meat, to avoid beings that are killed. But also keep in mind, you know, eating vegetables, how many beings gave their lives to get here? You know, the pesticides they may put on the crops, the insects, the tractor runs over farming them. You know, the trucks that run over animals delivering it. So we live in samsara. We're never going to be totally pure. We're never going to escape that. But it's an excellent aspiration, and if you are trying to be vegetarian, that certainly is meritorious.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other? Yeah.
Regarding the wrongdoing of wrong view, wrongdoing of wrong view, I've heard eternalism and nihilism described as extremes.
Yeah.
And I really get nihilism. That's pretty clear. But I can't wrap my head around eternalism. I've Googled it a few times. What is eternalism? What's your understanding and feel for what eternalism is?
Eternalism, I think, is a more Christian kind of belief, the immortal soul. And it's also is more material. Nihilism versus materiality, that things are real, that they exist, they self-exist on their own. It's kind of denying the emptiness of things. Is that getting at it?
Yeah, I think so. But I'm still a little fuzzy about it, but I see where you're going.
Yeah, no, it's looking at the world and things as real, as outside me, of things as having value that are intrinsic to them, and not mind-made, as it says in the Dhammapada.
So could that tie into materialism?
Yeah. Yeah, that is looking at things as being material, having materiality, that they self-exist. And so like a diamond is valuable because it's a diamond. Even though it's just a stone that we happen to value, and culturally we have agreed that diamonds are lovely things, and so we put a value on them. But in and of themselves, they're not worth very much. A dollar bill is a piece of paper, you know, worth less than a cent to prop manufacture, probably. And yet we give a great deal of value to it. We've all agreed on that. And yet a more materialistic view would kind of say the dollar is valuable because it's a dollar and because it's my dollar. Kind of leads to that. Is that helping?
It helps. Thank you.
So I've been reading a lot of articles or heard them on the people talking on the radio and things about decolonizing Buddhism. So come to find out, in the 19th century, when the British colonists came to Southeast Asia, they were fascinated with Buddhism, but they didn't like this Catholic stuff with the monks and the incense and devotion, and they just liked it as a philosophy, mm-hmm. and they liked the meditation practice. So one way we see that now is when meditation is taught for stress reduction and not for a larger purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken out of the religious context. So in my life, I started with transcendental meditation. It was in the 70s. I don't know what it's like now. So that was just my experience. But they taught the meditation, but that was it. There was no supporting like sangha and teachings about morality and discipline. And so it never went anywhere. But, all these teachings that you said, like paramitas, five precepts, eightfold path, four immeasurables, they're supported by the meditation,
mm-hmm.
and they support the meditation. And but we hear like yoga and Buddhism as being meditation being just for stress reduction, and mm-hmm. so it doesn't go anywhere. And a simpler way of that something that's been very helpful to me is think about misconduct was that if you choose to not do misconduct, it creates a clear mind stream. Because like you pick up a pen at a counter, and then every time I see that daggone pen in my house, I'm like, dang, I stole that. Why did I do that? Then I'll like give it away to the thrift store, but then I remember that I did it, and it's there in my mind forever. And you know, like if you write something snarky in the comments section, you just can't get out of your mind. Like you feel good at the time, but then later you're like, oh, why did I do that? So you know, it's like it's the selfish purpose, but it's also like the ultimate purpose to create the clear mind stream.
Yeah, very good. I have a problem with pens, too. I tend to be a pen thief. If I'm given a pen at a bank or something, it often winds up in my pocket. But no, I started with TM as well and got a lot out of it. The meditation greatly benefited me. And there was a small group I got involved with of meditators. But eventually, yeah, it didn't seem to be going far enough. And somebody pointed out to me that it was lacking compassion, loving kindness, and the rest. And I'm not sure what the colonizers were doing when they were first discovering the Dharma. A lot of their translations use a lot of Christian vocabulary that kind of distort it. But I know when Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberger, Joseph Goldstein, those guys really started to bring the Dharma to the United States, they wanted it to be somewhat acceptable. So they took a lot of the religion out of it and made it more just simply meditation. But they did add in a little bit more of the ethics, the sila, that kind of thing. Now, John Kabat-Zinn took just the mindfulness practice and created the mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I have no problem with that at all. It's a very good thing and helps a lot of people deal with stress, deal with real problems. It's not quite the Dharma, but it's a good start. And as I said at the beginning of the talks, if everybody in this country would meditate, we'd all be a lot happier with or out the rest of it. But, and sometimes I'm asked, is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy? And I usually say yes.
Yeah, my new slogan for the year, for the past 6 years, I try to think of a new slogan for the year. And every year it's always, go ahead and just be the love. And I can never get out of it. But I think I'm switching to, it's not either or, it's both and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The political situation has driven me to that.
It's what?
The political situation has driven me to a new slogan. It's not either or, it's both and.
No, the political situation, I think, is a great inspiration for all of us to deepen our practice. Work hard at it. Work very hard at compassion meditation, loving kindness meditation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
How are you, Roberta?
Thanks for your teaching this morning. I appreciate it. I just have a quick question about a definition or a meaning. When we say the four immeasurables, can you go into a little bit of detail what the word equanimity means?
Equanimity, that's always sort of a difficult one to talk about in a way. Basically, it means accepting things without judgment, without pushing away or grasping onto. It is imbued with loving kindness and compassion. It's different than indifference. In the Theravadin tradition, when they talk about the four immeasurables or the paramitas, they talk about the near enemies and the enemies. And the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. And because it looks the same, it looks like we don't care. But, you know, like if you go to court, you want a judge who's not indifferent, but who is a judge with an open mind that's going to hear all the facts, not pass any judgment until it's time to pass judgment, and accept all that. Does that help?
Yes.
Has that clarified some?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I really enjoyed your talk and the questions as well, or comments from the group. I just wanted to share that my experience has been, as I stumble along the path trying to do my best with precepts and concepts and all the principles involved, that if I'm doing that and mostly just becoming more and more aware in the moment and the now, sometimes situations will present themselves, when I call it, it's like the stars become aligned and you realize you're right at the right time at the right moment. Mm-hmm. I think they happen much more frequently, mm-hmm. but every so often I'm aware of them. And I had to share it. I just had one a few minutes ago here from the seat I was in. I was able to just look to my right, and this incredible image of of one of the members of the Sangha, totally focused on your talk and everything, and in the position of a loving, caring parent, had this incredible young bodhisattva in training sitting in his lap reading their book on Harry Potter, and it was just... I just can't describe the incredible, it was like everything was just perfect. We're here in this space, you're sharing such wisdom, he's totally focused, and she was right there where she should be, and it just, you know, I think it's all sort of a spillover of when you just allow yourself to, one moment at a time, try to just do the best you can with where you are at that moment. And I just wanted to share it with the group because I'll never forget that. That was an image that was just perfection. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I guess Harry Potter is good dharma. Yeah, no, paying attention, being mindful, lots of things can kind of arise that are good. And as you practice more, I guess, one of the Lojong slogans that I've always kind of thought was important for me is, be grateful for everything, for the difficulties that come up because they give us an opportunity to practice. And as one of the teachers said, the more we practice, the fewer difficulties we'll have, so the more we need to be grateful for them. And so I think that's something to keep in mind, that as we go through this path, things will get better, they will improve. Although other teachings have said, was that, I think in the Diamond Cutter Sutra when I was studying that years ago, one of the passages in it said, anyone that really studies this can expect a lot of bad things to happen because your karma will ripen and will come up all at once. So you will get rid of a lot of karma, but you'll have to deal with the suffering of that. So anyway, lots of things there. Lots to think about, lots to practice with. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you. And thank you for everyone's comments. It's brought up a lot of things I often think about. And I was recently reading an article about restorative justice that I think would help people with. We tend to be a judgmental and critical society, and we want to blame others or find who is at blame. And this article was so inspiring to me because a teacher asked her if she was tired of being, and she said, yes, I'm tired of being angry. And he said, so why not align with the person who did the wrongdoing and consider what their needs were? And I just thought that's a radical way of helping us dive into compassion and say, their intention might have been okay. Their action might have been, we would all agree, wrong. But that kind of helps... open that door that we're resistant to.
Yeah, very good. I like restorative justice. For those of you who don't know, restorative justice is sort of a new idea. It's been around for some time, but it's getting more traction, I think, in the justice system. And basically, it's the idea of restoring the offender to community. There's usually three pieces to it. You have a moderator, you have the victim, and you have the offender. And they sit down. The moderator or somebody there should be representing the community. So if somebody offends the community, how do you heal? How do you bring them back into the community? What do they have to do? And so that's what you work through. It's not necessarily giving them a pass.
Right.
You know, I had somebody break into my house a couple of years ago while I was there. It's a long story. But, you know, we talked to the prosecutor a little bit about restorative justice. And this guy turned out to be mentally ill. People were saying he must have been on drugs. The problem was he wasn't on drugs. He should have been taking antipsychotic medications. But we did work out something. He wrote us a nice letter apologizing for his act. He's been sending us $50 a month until we found out, tragically, he had a little bit of a relapse and got involved with using illicit drugs and wound up freezing to death last January. So, Lamont Brown, if you want to hold him in your practice. But it's a great idea, restorative justice, and it's something I wish we would work on, of healing, of bringing people back into the community.
Yes, and I would say as we develop our mindfulness and awareness that sometimes it happens auspiciously for ourselves. Maybe a friend or a parent said something that cut us deeply, and then years later they say something that kind of restores your sense of self-worth. And then there's a magical moment where you go, oh, yeah. My gosh,
yeah,
that was so healing. No one else would understand mm-hmm. it but me because I was there for it. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for, these precepts are very many levels.
Yeah. Well, they kind of resonate at all kinds of levels. Yes, they go very deep. Mm-hmm. And as somebody pointed out once, hating or wanting to harm your enemy is kind of like drinking poison and expecting your enemy to die. It won't work that way.
Thank you.
So, is there one more question? Or? Sure.
Yes, I was listening to Minjo Rinpoche's teaching this morning, and he kind of included three things in the Buddhism. One is the ethics, mm-hmm. the other one is meditation, and the third one is wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So importance of the ethics is when you meditate, it kind of give you wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think you have wisdom, you think you can do whatever you feel like, and ethics kind of guide you afterward, like the lady mentioned over there, I think. So they kind of all go together. It's just not something
Yes, they
else.
Do. They feed on one another, and it's all of them are essential parts of the path. But for many of us, you know, we can begin with resolving to follow the precepts, just simple rules. We can all do that. As we meditate, it'll become more and more interactive with the others, and we'll develop more wisdom. Our meditation will be there. So I would like to thank you all to be here. I hope this week you can contemplate the precepts, give some thought to how you will keep them, maybe pick one to really work on intensely, very carefully for the week. And anyway, let's spend a moment dedicating the merit that all beings may find their way to the Dharma, that they may be virtuous and find their way to practicing the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. So let's just sit for a few minutes. And thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.